Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books and Biography, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Creasa Pugh, and I'm an assistant professor of sociology at the New School in New York City. Today, my guest is Dr. Craig Seymour, who's a music critic and academic and author of Luther, The Life and Longing of Luther Vandross, which we'll discuss today. Dr. Seymour was born in Washington, D.C., and has written for The Washington Post, Entertainment Weekly, Vibe, and Spend, among other publications, and has served as pop music critic for The Buffalo News and the Atlantic Journal Constitution. He holds a PhD in American Studies from the University of Maryland, College Park. Dr. Seymour has interviewed and profiled some of the biggest names in music, including Janet Jackson, Mariah Carey, and Luther Vandross, who granted him numerous interviews. Dr. Seymour has also been a music analyst for CNN's Headline News. Today, we'll be discussing Dr. Seymour's book, Luther, The Life and Longing of Luther Vandross, which was published in 2005 by Harper Paperbacks. The biography chronicles the life of the famed singer and producer, including his lifelong love of music and his infatuations with girl groups, particularly Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells and Dionne Warwick. In the book, Seymour includes many profiles of many musicians who helped Vandross along his way. Dr. Seymour, it's a real pleasure to welcome you to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. And please just call me Craig.
Okay. We'll do. So could we begin just by you telling us a little bit about yourself and what brought you to this project? Like, what was the inspiration behind the book and writing about Luther's life?
Well, I was born in 1968. So I have experienced Luther's entire recording career. So I remember growing up and hearing his voice on commercials. I remember the impact when Never Too Much came out and when A House Is Not a Home just transformed the Quiet Storm Radio and everything. So I grew up with Luther. The first Luther album I bought myself was Busybody, and I was like maybe 13 or 14. And that album just spoke to me so deeply, I think, because of the longing in it. And I was probably somewhat aware of my of being gay, but not quite understanding it. And it's just one of those experiences that I think many of us have where you're listening to somebody and it feels like somebody's expressing your deepest thoughts or somebody. I just had such a connection with that album. So, and then I was lucky enough to be able to see Luther live back in the day, where it was it was so different from any concert I'd been to, because he put on such a theatrical performance. He had a dancer come out and do like Alvin Ailey-ish dance moves to Superstar. And it just really blew my mind aesthetically. So he's just was a huge part of my just development as a person who loved music, everything. So cut to, I guess, when I became a music critic, and Luther hadn't really, so I really started in the music game kind of in the late 90s. And that was during a period of almost kind of a hiatus for Luther. So then when when he was making his big comeback in 2001, with the album, the self-titled album, but it has, a lot of people remember it, it has Take You Out on it. I just had to be the person that was going to write about that for Vibe. Like, there was just no way. Cause I was writing a lot of things for a lot of cover stories and everything. And that was just one of those things that, like, no, I will be the one doing this assignment. So, and also, I mean, everybody thought that I would be perfect for it. So I had the opportunity to fly to Jamaica with him and spend all this time with him as he was preparing for a Mother's Day concert. And it was just really one of those remarkable moments looking back, because I've had a lot of opportunities to visit with celebrities and see them in intimate settings and everything like that. But just knowing that that really was going to be one of his last moments and his last big profile, a person who had always been underreported in the music press anyway, and there hadn't been a lot of big profiles of him. I just treasure that experience. So then what happened? I've always wanted to write a book. So I was, at this point, I was working a lot in journalism and just having this desire to write a book. Had been, like a lot of people, I've been turned down many times by many different agents, many different ideas. But, and we can talk about this a little bit more, because I think it's very telling into how Black stories are told. But when Luther had his stroke, I was in conversation with an agent. And we were talking about a lot of different ideas. And I just kind of threw out, oh, you know, I could do a Luther Vandross biography, not in order to capitalize on his ailment at the time, but more as just a realization that nobody had done that. And so I pitched it to her and she liked the idea. And then she, it sold very quickly. In retrospect, I realized that I sort of look back at that with a lot of ambivalence, because I really, in trying to pitch books on other artists since then, I really realized that the publishing industry was only interested in this man because he had suffered of the stroke. And that just, I just have so many mixed emotions about that. Now, but at the time, it didn't really feel like that. It felt much more like, because I guess just in terms of my intentions, it felt much more like just an opportunity to celebrate him. But just seeing how the publishing industry works in terms of whether or not they support biographies of Black artists, it just seems like the support really isn't there. And I just feel like this book just got written really by chance, which is just so tragic in terms of us thinking about how Black stories are told and the importance of Black stories being told. I didn't mean to make that be such a downer, but that's just, yeah, I just had to be honest.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, and that's where the book starts. You know, you start with his stroke. And that was one of the questions that I had for you was, you know, in terms of kind of, you know, the editorial process, you know, you could have started anywhere. Like, you could have started, you know, from when he was born, you know, but you kind of decided to start the book with the stroke. And I was wondering about that. Like, I was wondering, you know, kind of what series of decisions, and I think you kind of answered this and feel free to elaborate, but, you know, it seems like, you know, it was so central to the story that you were telling. And then of course, you know, he dies, if I'm not mistaken, in the same year that the book is published, like not too long after, the year after the stroke. Is that correct?
Yeah, the book was actually published when he was still alive.
Okay.
In hardback.
Uh-huh.
The paperback came out within days of when he passed.
Mm-hmm.
And I know exactly the moment when I found out that he had passed. For some reason, I was driving from New York to DC, and I was listening to Wendy Williams, like a lot of people did back in those days, and I literally found out that he had passed on the Wendy Williams show, and I had to pull off on one of those rest areas that they have on the New Jersey Turnpike, and just, I think I might have sat there for half hour, an hour, but and I didn't even, I wasn't crying. I didn't even, but it was just such a, just bizarre feeling about to launch the paperback of this book. Like I had been having all of these conversations, all these emails about the book tour and who I was going to do interviews with and all of this stuff. So I was very much in kind of promotion mode and everything. And at least for me, just always hoping that, always retaining the hope that Luther was going to be able to, I didn't really care if Luther was going to be able to like perform again or do concerts. I mean, who cares? But just to be able to live and have some sort of life after that. I mean, I had really been holding on to that hope and believing in it, because he had made an appearance on Oprah Winfrey not that long before that, where he was singing and just joking with his friends and everything. So I just was in that frame of mind of this man is going to recover and he's going to go on and everything like that. And of course, my intention was always to celebrate his work and to just make his work part of a historical record so that people could have a source to go back to. And then just finding out that he passed, like in the midst of being in that particular headspace, was just, I still don't really have any words for it, but it was a very, it was just a bizarre circumstance. It was just very strange.
Yeah,
but I can. In the retrospect, though, I'm very, very glad that I was able. I believe in purpose and believe in things are meant to be and everything like that. And I just think that it was so great that I was able to talk about him so much, because I had done this book on him at the time when he had passed. And a lot of people were interested in talking about him because he had passed. So I felt like, you know, they say, if you stay ready, you don't have to get ready. It's like, I was ready. And I think I was able to really communicate the importance of his artistry to people at that pivotal time. So I look at it as a good thing now, but it was very strange and disorienting in the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I can imagine that being very, very unsettling and very jarring to be kind of in that headspace when you learn. And also just on an emotional level. I mean, like you said, you know, and your introductory remarks that, you know, he's someone that you've been kind of, you've grown up with and you, you know, had this connection to him and, you know, through identity and, you know, through the music, you know, he's been a very influential person in your life. And so just even on that level, I can imagine that just being really hard. So, the timing is really incredible though, to think about. It's really, I mean, I was trying to track that and, you know, it's, and because I think you open with this, you know, narrative about the stroke, it's like, there is, even in the moments, you know, of the book that are, you know, lighthearted and, you know, his sense of humor comes out throughout the entire book. And yet at the same time, it's because you know that, you know, he had suffered this incredible illness. Like he'd suffered the stroke, you know, people, you know, it wasn't clear if he was going to make it out, you know, and then he passed away, you know, not long thereafter. It's like, there is still this kind of, yeah, this heaviness that sits with the book, even while you're reading through these really kind of, you know, beautiful moments and joyful moments and, you know, funny moments, it's still, you know, it's still there. And so I think I really appreciated the fact that you led with that, especially given the timing that, you know, it was published and all of this was going on. And then I think I imagine, you know, for people who were reading it in 2005, as it came out, you know, right after he passed, I imagine that that was a deeply cathartic, you know, emotional experience for everyone who was reading. So in a way, I agree. It almost like, yeah, you know, obviously don't want to be exploitative, but, you know, it just seemed like it was really like a kind of necessary timing for people who were grieving. So I understand now the ambivalence that you're referring to.
Yeah. And I think part of it, and maybe this comes through in the book, but I mean, after meeting him and having a conversation with him, I was just really rooting for him to be able to find the sort of specific happiness that he wanted, because he was very specific about the things that he thought would bring him happiness. Now, who knows? I mean, a lot of us are specific about the things that we want and then we turn out to be wrong and they don't give us, but I think you should at least have the opportunity to go for that and learn yourself. And I mean, he really wanted love. Mm-hmm. And he really wanted a number one pop single. Mm-hmm. And to the best of my knowledge, he was not able to get either one of those. And that is heartbreaking to me. But the important part about it, and I think I sort of try to emphasize this when I write the book, and as we were speaking earlier, knowing Luther's humble beginnings from the projects to know people telling him that he would never be able to be a performer to becoming one of the most renowned and celebrated R&B artists of all time, that's a journey that you just can't discount. And that's more than most people ever have or could ever even hope for. So the journey is wondrous. It's just that there were, in addition to that, there were also some very specific things that he wanted as a human being that he wasn't able to get. So there's that sort of, and that, you know, hence the book, The Life and Longing of Luther Vandross. I think the life was so amazing. You know, he's one of his songs, but the longing was still always there. And right. Maybe it's always there with all of us. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'd love to go back to that moment when you had this conversation with him. So you mentioned, you know, you had taken this trip to Jamaica and, you know, it's you paint such it is a fantastic portrait. I mean, that is one of my favorite parts of the book. I mean, you talk about this really heartwarming moment when he's performing and his mother, you know, kind of walks up and she grabs you and thanks you for writing about her son, which is just so touching. And then you start, you know, talking about the fact that you went to the step class with him. It's just hilarious imagining you in this like step class with Luther and all of his backup dancers and singers.
I did not take part in this. I was an observer.
Question. I was wondering.
I want to make that very clear. I was an observer. But yeah, it was a very humorous because I don't even remember specifically if this is in the book, but, you know, they were playing. I talk a lot in the book about how his musical grounding is really in a lot of old fashioned soul and stuff like that. So they were playing records from that era. So like they were playing I'm a Soul Man and Luther was I'm a Soul Man. And he was saying the word really long. So it really was quite a distinctive picture of somebody that you're used to seeing in such a refined, controlled manner. And it was just a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's such a wonderful part of the book. But you know, what really sticks out about that encounter that you had with him was the interview that you had and where you specifically, I mean, you're very direct and you ask him, you're asking him about his love life. You're asking him why it is that he hasn't, you know, found love. If, you know, you're asking him about, you know, the extent to which, you know, the sacrifices that he's made for his career, that yielded this kind of like desire for love that had so far been unfulfilled. You were asking if it was worth, like, you were asking these really penetrating questions. How did that feel to be in that conversation with him? Like, how did he respond to those kinds of questions? Yeah. Like, what was that experience like for you having such an intimate conversation with him about something that was both on one hand, so public in a way, like so many people were, you know, speculating and talking about his love life, and yet he was so private about it.
I would have to say, you know, I don't want to say over-prepare, but I extensively prepare for every single interview. So I'm always able to sort of reference something somebody said in the past or something like that. So it's like I'm building upon things that they said as opposed to just coming right out and asking something out of nowhere. So I think a lot of what I did was kind of like say, oh, you said that you were like, for, you know, so a lot of my questions were based upon things that he had already said, things that he had said in his songs. So I think that was more, that helped contextualize it. It really, and I think also just, we had a rapport from the very beginning. It was a very kind of like sparring type of rapport, but it was a rapport nonetheless where I could say something and he would tell me, well, no, you can't do that or whatever. But there was a genuine, I think he could tell that I had a genuine empathy for him. I was not just trying to get him to make some headlining statement or something like that. I was really, I mean, as a fan, as a human being, I was really interested in his happiness and his search for love. So that's where all the questions came from my perspective. And I think he took it as such. At the same time, he said, whenever I got close to asking if there's anything queer, you know, you are riding around the airport. You ain't never going to land. Like, he was never going to answer that question. But he acknowledged that I was hovering around an airport, so the airport must exist. You know what I mean? And it was just so funny because whenever somebody, we were having this conversation outside, some of it, and whenever somebody would come back, he was like, oh yeah, I'm just talking to this guy from Vibe. He wants to give me all in my business that he ain't gonna get, but you know, yeah, we're just talking. I'll get with you in a minute. Yeah, we're just, you know, it was very, it was very a comfortable conversation. And in a lot, I would say in all of the aspects where we were talking about his love life, I think I was talking to somebody who really wanted to get some things off their chest. That the things that he told me about his search for love and not being able to find love and where he was at that point in his life of evaluating whether or not the way that he had talked about his love life was going to work for him moving forward, I think those were things that he really, really did want to talk about with the right, with a sympathetic, with a person that wasn't just trying to be all in his business, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he could tell that you cared. Yeah. That's, I mean, I think that's very evident. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, you have there's so much intimacy in the book. Like, you really bring us into, you know, his homes, the relationships that he has with various, you know, individuals in the industry, you know, his own family members. How did you gather all of this? I mean, this must have been a Herculean effort. It's like, so you had this, you know, you had, you know, some interviews with Luther, but, you know, you have all these quotes from, you know, Mary Ida, his mother. You have quotes from all these other folks that, you know, in the industry, you have folks from other family members, you know, confidants, friends. Like, how did you build the book? Like, what was the process of, you know, you really kind of getting into the interior lives of not just Luther, but a lot of the cast of characters who surrounded him, you know, for his 50 plus years on Earth? Like, how did you construct that?
Well, I just have to say, I love that you said the thing about interior lives, because one of my dear, dear friends of decades was Valerie Boyd, who wrote the Zora Neale Hurston biography. And we both were working at the Atlanta Journal Constitution at the time. You know, I was with her through the final part of her writing the Hurston bio and getting it together for publication and stuff like that. And she was the person that introduced me to the agent that sold the Luther book. So we would have a lot of biographer conversations. And the entire, her entire sort of thing about what you have to do in a biography and what makes a good biography is that you have to capture the interior life. So that was something that I was going into it with. And other than that, it really was just a matter of old-fashioned reporting. I mean, I did not interview a lot of people for the book. Most of the stuff comes from other sources and other interviews, but in order to capture that interior life, it did mean doing things like, as I mentioned to you before, going to the place where he grew up, just walking around there, trying to get a feel of it, and just kind of researching with the aim to capture things that felt as if they reflected an interior emotional life, instead of, oh, he went to this studio on this day, he went to that studio on that day. But just that was always my sort of guiding light of trying to capture that. So I think that that's where all the reporting and stuff comes from. The strange part of this book, and this is one of those things, you know, for anybody that's younger out there, you know, use your youth wisely, because that book was written in, from start to finish, it was supposed to be 6 months, but it actually ended up being 9 months because I needed an extension because I had a death in the family. I actually really don't know how I did it because I could never do that now. I think a lot of times, and this is one thing I like about myself, but I always get myself kind of in trouble for that. They wanted the book right away because they wanted it to be out for Mother's Day of the following year. I think I got the deal in 2003, so it came out in 2000. I think they wanted it out in Mother's Day of 2004 or something. They really just wanted to crash this book. So the short time I had to write it was contingent upon the deal. Like, I didn't have the negotiation space to say, oh no, this is going to take me 3 years because I need a year to research and a year to... No, they were like, okay, you can get this deal. You can get it at this... And I knew I had to immediately take a book leave from my job and just do everything like that and just focus on that 100%. And it really was just, I cannot explain to you how I did it. Toward the end, it was to a point where I was writing an entire chapter in a day. And the other, and here's the weird thing too. I don't type very well. So I write everything longhand and then have to like, pray or beg or something, a friend or my mom or somebody like that too. So my deadlines always, I have to build in that extra time of having somebody type it and then having to read back what they typed and make sure that it's correct. So it was crazy. I mean, my dad talks about it a lot with me, that because one thing I would do is for part of the book was written in Toronto, then I had a death in the family, my stepfather died, and I went to help my mom and my little brother just dealing with all of that. And then at one point I just like locked myself in like a Hotel Inn Express. I was just, and you know, put the Do Not Disturb sign on the door. They didn't clean it for a week. And I just literally stayed in there all day. But my best friend was typing it for me and he was working at Yale at the time. And so I had to FedEx, this was before scanning was easy. So I had to FedEx my handwritten copies to him so he could have it the next day so he could turn it over. So I would call my dad and there was this FedEx deadline and it wouldn't be the normal FedEx deadline. I would drive all the way out to the airport to that FedEx, which the deadline was like 7:30 or something like that. So I would always call my dad on the ride from when I stopped writing to when I went and sent the handwritten pages off to FedEx. So yes, it was entirely crazy. I don't know how I did it and I don't recommend it and I know I could never do it again.
That's incredible. I mean, it is amazing to think back on. Yeah, it's funny that you know, kind of open this by saying use your youth wisely, because it's like, it really does feel like another person kind of did this. It's like, how could you possibly, we have like technology and, you know, ways that probably would have been more helpful then, but that's incredible to think about. I mean, and that just makes the story even richer in a way to know that that is how you were generated, because it's really, I mean, if you had told me that you'd written it over 6 years, I would have believed you. It's so beautifully written and it's so evocative and the prose are incredible. So, I mean, it's shocking. It's like inspirational, but it's shocking to hear that you wrote it in 6 to 9 months. It's incredible.
Yeah, I have no idea. It's to the point where like it was even, I had no perspective on it for like the first couple of years because I had written it so fast and I just almost didn't even know like what I didn't know if I had accomplished my goal. I didn't know if people were going to read it and think, oh, this is just something he threw out and, you know, why did he even waste his time? You know, I really didn't know because I just did the best that I could do in the time that I had to do it. And I really had no perspective on what it would mean. I just, you know, the only thing that I can say as far as, because I guess a lot of writers listen to this, you know, a lot of people that want to write biographies and stuff like that. The only thing I can say is like, I think the most important thing in this, maybe you could just say in life in general, but just having an intention is just so important. Because I knew what my intention was. I knew that, I wanted this to be a book that really explained how this man emerged out of a community and out of a Black cultural context to really reframe R&B music. And I knew that I wanted it to be to touch the heart. You know, so I had, and I still do this now, you know, I don't even remember what the specific intention was, but I know I had an intention. Once I locked into the fact of him having this eternal longing, I knew that that was sort of a guiding light. And then the other thing I do is sort of put up just emotions that I know that I want to evoke. So I knew I wanted it to be funny because I thought Luther was very funny. And I knew I wanted it to be very heartfelt because Luther's music touches people so deeply in their heart. So I can only hope and imagine that just having those things in my mind, then that became the filter through which I did all the research, and that became the filter, and that became the guiding light as I was putting down these words in the most hurried fashion that I've ever done in my career. But just if you have that intention and you know what you're trying to do, I guess you end up kind of coming close to that and doing it. You know, that's my only, because it certainly wasn't it was not at the point that I was relying on craft or relying on kind of manipulating the individual words. It really was about having sort of a holistic vision and then just trusting that that was going to come out on the page.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And so how did that, I want to follow up on that a little bit, because you had mentioned that, you know, when you were kind of in this, you know, production mode, you know, thinking about the book tour when you learned of his passing, you know, were you able to, you know, kind of get the book out there in the way that you had wanted to? I mean, like, I'm curious, how was it ultimately when you sent it off and when it was published, how was it received?
Well, that my editor wanted it to be more salacious. So she was, I guess, upset that there wasn't more like scandal, and I think she also wanted it to be a sort of meaner portrait of him in a way, in that he had a reputation for, I guess, being difficult or whatever, which I think is all in the book, but I contextualize it as to why he would be feeling this way in any given moment. So I think that, I had another person that knew him say to me that I made him too nice. And I was just like, well, I mean, I just didn't know what to do with that, because I think I just tried to do a balanced portrait. And I think that you understand where he came from and what he was going through at any given time. So maybe you are more sympathetic to how he might have reacted in a or harshly in a particular moment. But I don't think my job as a biographer is to make somebody come off as me or any particular one way. I think I'm just trying to provide the context of somebody's life and just then present the facts as they are. And you can take them however you want it. I mean, I think a good example is like the En Vogue or the feud with En Vogue or like the Anita Baker situation. I just tried to present those facts as they were and both sides of the both perspectives, but I don't think I lean toward ever saying like Luther was right or justified in doing any particular thing. I just sort of present it as it is, and you can think what you want to think of it. So that was one thing. So she was, the editor was not 100% thrilled with it, to be perfectly honest, but she had no comments. The only editorial comment she had was one part of the book, which I didn't even remember when she was bringing this up to me on the phone. Because this was back when it wasn't like Google Docs, like the editors just like called you. So at one random point in the book, I think I mentioned something about Diana Ross going to a concert and that she took a helicopter to the venue. And literally the editor said, and I just didn't understand this part because I didn't know what heliport she landed in, because I'm familiar with all the heliports in Upper Manhattan and it either had to be this one or that one. And I'm just thinking, okay. And that was literally the only comment that the main editor had on. Of course, you go through things with the copy editor, but that was that was the only editorial comment. It wasn't anything about the content or anything. I'm just like thinking, wow, you are really fishy if you have if you're worried about like Diana Ross's health. I mean, it wasn't even central to the story, so it was very weird. So then, okay, so let's cut to the sort of reviews and stuff like that, and the first. This is another example. I hate to be like, you know, teaching spiritual lessons through writing or anything like that, but I do think that there are just some interesting things because in the writing, one of my biggest concerns, and, you know, there's this thing like what you focus on expands, you know, and not kind of like staying in that place of fears. But one of my biggest fears was that somebody was going to call the book superficial. That somebody was going to think the book was superficial. And do you know that the only advance review of the book was in Publishers Weekly, and the one and they specifically said they thought the book was superficial. So it was like,
oh no.
What? And so it was heartbreaking until I got the perspective of thinking, you know, A, I don't focus on bad things. I don't try to not to focus on what the bad reaction to something is going to be anymore, because I do think that puts you in trouble. But then in a way it was freeing, because I was like, oh, well, you know, this one reviewer said the worst thing that you thought somebody could say about the book. So it's already been said. So in many ways, it was also freeing, because I was just like, okay, well, what my worst fear was has now been achieved before the book has even been out. So basically anything after that is sort of like, what, you know, okay, you know, if that's what you think, that's what you think.
Mm-hmm. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, this conversation has gotten really emotional. We were so lighthearted when we were talking. I'm like, this conversation has gotten so emotional. But that's great.
It's all instructive, though. It's all good. I mean, it was kind of going back to your point about someone saying that you were a little bit, you know, too nice to Luther in a way. I think that, you know, even, I mean, you did. I think that there was the moments where you do talk about, you know, the kind of difficulty of working with him and those examples of, you know, En Vogue and Anita Baker, it's like, even those those moments that you describe, even those are like quite funny, you know, like in a way it's like that, one of my favorite parts when, you're talking about kind of in the midst of the En Vogue feud and he, you know, he kind of has this like curtain constructed so that he doesn't have to see them backstage. And then one of the members of En Vogue, you know, kind of whatever, accidentally or maybe intentionally is like on the wrong side, on Luther's side of the curtain, and he calls the cops on her. It's just like, even Luther in his like meanest moments is still just hilarious. Like, it's hilarious to think about. I mean, it's just
shade, right?
Like the absurdity and just like, I mean, he's just such a diva in like so many of these moments. And it's like, even if there was like a kind of mean spiritedness to it, it's also, there was just, you know, even that was just, I mean, there was so much humor in the book, even in kind of like that, you know, even though there were such dark moments, but I just really appreciated that you were able to balance like, you know, this, like, you know, this idea of like a very kind of public feud. And then, you know, they go, you know, they end up going public with it and, you know, coining him Lucifer and all, you know, it's really kind of damaging. And yet, you know, it's still just this kind of like, you know, all these funny anecdotes come out of it. So, I mean, along those lines though, are there, were there any stories, you know, that kind of you discovered, you know, through the process? I know it's, you know, been a while, obviously, since you've written the book, but, do you have any favorite stories of Luther that either, you know, were in the book or, you know, are not in the book, but that you discovered in this process or that you even, I mean, the step class in Jamaica is just incredible, but, you know, any stories, you know, that you and yourself experience or ones that you heard of in the process of writing this book about Luther?
Well, one of my favorite parts is, I mean, even to somebody that knew his career so much, I still didn't have a sort of sense of all the time that passed that he was just in the background. Like from when he did the David Bowie tour and Bowie was like, oh, you're going to be a superstar like next year. And it was like over a decade later and just all the many tries that he had that didn't work out. And yet he persevered. So what some of my, so some of my favorite stories come from that, like just thinking about just the idea of this like sheltered guy with this church going mother and all this kind of stuff and just kind of, you know, living in, anybody that knows New York knows that like at one point it's kind of like, or at least back then and stuff, it's sort of like the center of the media world and sort of the center, but it's also completely its own place. And so when you go outside of that, it can be kind of jarring. So just the idea of this person that grew up in such a sheltered environment, like instantly going on, almost immediately going on tour with David Bowie in this wild thing. And then David even asked him to open the shows. So just the funny things, I think David Sanborn may have told me this, but just the things about everybody doing drugs and he didn't do drugs or didn't even really know what they were doing and didn't know, you know, and they would be saying things like, oh, we have a cold. And you know, he would take it at face value. And it turned out they were up all night doing drugs or whatever. Like, that's just kind of hilarious to me because I just can visualize it. I just see this kid trying to make, young Luther trying to make sense of this just crazy. I mean, things that would have been, that are even looking back sort of wild, just even by rock and roll standards, you know? And then I think I talked to Christine Wiltshire, who was a member of his group, Luther, that a lot of people don't even know about, that he actually had a whole group called Luther. And just, she was just cracking up about just talking about, and I don't know how much that even, this even comes through on the book, because a lot of it's just in our conversation, but just the way she was laughing at how her hair looked and how their hair looked and him all in the tight three-piece suit and on the album cover and just all of that kind of stuff. That was just so funny because it just made me realize that it's so easy to think, to look retrospectively back on somebody's career and think that there was some kind of master plan and it was sort of like they were on this journey that was inevitable, that would inevitably lead them to stardom. But when you really go back and research somebody's life and talk to the people that were around, you realize that people are just figuring out as they go along, like everybody else, and faking it till you make it and all of that. And so anytime I had a story like that, it was just kind of funny to me.
Totally. Yeah. It just, it is, it's amazing. And it really was, and it was just, it was so cyclical. Like it was almost to the point where like these, you know, these cycles that, you know, Luther was going through, it almost became kind of predictable in a way. It's like, okay, he like has this like, you know, kind of near stardom. And then, you know, he almost gets to like, you know, the top of the charts, like so many times that he has like, you know, platinum after platinum after platinum album, but never gets that like number one hit on Billboard Pop. And then like, he gets so close a couple times, he gets to number three and then he doesn't get it. And then he like, you know, gets depressed and then, you know, he starts eating again. And then, you know, he, you know, reconfigures and gets, you know, a new group and relaunches his career. And then someone dies and then he starts eating again. And so it's like the cycle that is, it's so tragic. But I think, you know, and it comes out so beautifully in the book, I think this kind of, just this, like the way that kind of like you progress through his life in a way that's informed by, you know, these friends of his. I mean, that's a great story. yeah, about Luther the Band. I mean, that was a moment when I was just like, there's so many parts of his story that I didn't know. And then to hear that he had this band and to see that photo of the back of the album and, you know, this like, yeah, it's just, I mean, it's both like entertaining and heartbreaking. I mean, it's all of that. So I just, yeah, I mean, I just kind of went through the book highlighting all of these stories that were, and the Bowie story is incredible. I mean, I knew that he, you know, I had seen the video, you know, where he was singing backup vocals for Young Americans, but I knew that, you know, he had this Bowie connection, but I had no idea how pivotal Bowie was to launching his career. I had no idea that he was that influential and kind of, you know, quote unquote, discovered him, or is one of the people that kind of discovered him. So, and I think that's one of the beautiful parts about the book is that you really do this great job of, you know, kind of writing all the almost kind of like microbiographies within this larger biography of all of these different characters. So, you know, and talking about all of these obsessions that Luther had with all of these girl groups and, you know, these women, you know, soul singers. So yeah, who would you say, I mean, were some of his biggest influences, and who in turn would you say he also influenced, who's still making music today?
Oh, that's a really wonderful question. I would say probably one of the singular most important influences in his entire life would be Sissy Houston, Whitney Houston's mother, because he was, and for people that don't know, they sang, they were their own group, but they also sang background on, a lot of Aretha Franklin's signature hits, like that Sissy Houston doing that high note on Ain't No Way, which it's hard to imagine Ain't No Way without that high note. And so he was obsessed with them as background vocals. He always loved background vocals. He loved them as a group. And then it was just a relationship that they always maintained, because then they would be working together as background singers together. You know, he'd be side by side with this woman that he grew up revering. So they sang background on Chaka Khan's Naughty album. And that was one of Whitney's first credits, you know, so they were all together. And then when he became in his recording career, he would always hire her to sing backgrounds on his album. So I just think that's such a sustain. And I was able to talk to her, which was just such an honor. And I just think that's such a sustained relationship that really was not about being in the spotlight or not about wanting thing from each other. Like, it just seems like this a really strong emotional connection. And that was just a bond, because Luther would release album after album, right? So like they were always working together, and she was always on the record. So just this long sustained relationship. I just think that's just really powerful to me. Was that a good answer? Did that answer your question?
Yeah, okay.
Did you want me to say like Patti LaBelle?
Yeah, that was great. And
Patti LaBelle is another person, because of course he was obsessed with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, and he was their first fan club president. And Miss LaBelle would say like he was harassing them after the show, always running after them and everything like that. And then of course they later became kind of peers and friends as peers, and then they would have a kind of, you know, competitive relationship, trying to outspend each other at these, you know, LA stores and everything like that. So I think that's another relationship that was just very important and consistent throughout his life. But I just think that was more kind of high profile and in the public, where the relationship with Ms. Houston is kind of more in the background. And then, of course, we also know that the person he was most obsessed with as a sort of boy and then into this teen and 20 years was Aretha Franklin. And then, of course, they ended up having a very both supportive / rocky relationship throughout their career. So it's just throughout their lives. So it's really interesting, just the fact that he ended up working with all of his childhood idols. And that's part of what I mean when I just say his life was just amazing. His life was more than most of us will ever, you know, hope, or in that sort of cycle about how he ended up being able to help, and the people that he grew up loving, and they ended up being able to help him, and all of that kind of stuff. But he was just obsessed with having that number one pop hit, and he was just obsessed with having that a certain type of love. And, you know, I just often try to think, like, I think, is that an example? And I do think that he was completely appreciative and understanding of what he accomplished and everything like that. But, you know, like, I don't know, like, we all, when I think about that, when I hear Serena Williams talk about her winning, you know, she always wants to win that next Grand Slam and stuff like that. And so I don't know, is that something that motivates people, or is that something that is like a hindrance? I really can't come to a conclusion about that, other than I guess people that are in their field just want to be excellent in their field. And maybe that's just all it was. And maybe for ambitious people, that's just always going to be there. There's always going to be that desire to climb a higher mountain and to reach that peak. So I think there are a lot of like life lessons in the book, and or if not lessons, but there's just a lot of ways to reflect on your own life based upon what he went through.
Totally.
That happened with me, even in just writing the book. It just made me, and it's something I come back to a lot, just thinking about those types of things in his life, to trying to like contextualize or make peace with the things that I want my career and the things that I want in my life, and just how I'm even viewing my life. Am I looking at the things that I don't have, or am I looking at the things that I do have and have accomplished?
Right. Right. Absolutely. And he was so specific about the, about that desire. I mean, this idea that he, you know, it wasn't enough that he had reached number one on the R&B charts. Like, he wanted to be number one on the pop charts. Like, he wanted to be that crossover artist, you know? And so it was, you know, you're so right that he was so specific about the things that he desired and the things that he felt like he never really achieved. And, you know, and the same, you know, goes for, you know, his interest in love and romance that was like so specific and yet, you know, seems so unattainable. And then what about, so, you know, and I'm curious about, like contemporary artists or more recent artists that you feel like he influenced as well. I know at the kind of toward the end of the book, you talk about how he had, on one of his last albums, he collaborated with Beyonce, who at the time was still, you know, the front woman of Destiny's Child, and he just loved her. And so, you know, and the fact that she's, you know, still making, I mean, obviously like kind of the peak of her career, arguably. And, you know, I wonder, you know, to what extent do you feel like she's been influenced by Luther, or other people who are making music today were influenced by him?
That is a really excellent question. One thing I will say, just because I don't know if it's just speaking for the spirit of Luther, okay, but he would always, because I said something similar, and he would clap back and say that he always loved going number one R&B, and he always was fully embracing that, the fact that he had such a unwaveringly supportive Black audience. But what he would say is that he feels like he should also be able to get a number one in addition to that. Like, he never wanted to sacrifice his Black audience to get that. He just wanted that. I always countered him, which he didn't like, with the examples of the people that he would say that had that crossover success did not have the longevity, the contemporary relevance to R&B that he still had. Because he would throw out like a person like Bobby McFerrin or Billy Ocean or Lionel Richie. And all of those people are wonderful. And, you know, of course, Black folks love Lionel Richie, from the Commodores to the whatever. But in terms of like who's showing up to the shows and everything like that, Luther had a huge Black audience in a way that they did not have at that particular moment. So I saw it as kind of, I tried to contextualize that, but he didn't like that at all. So that is what it is. I was really struggling when you initially said like the artists that are influenced by him, because I think vocally he is just very, very singular in a way that is just hard, difficult to emulate. Partly because I think masculinity is still sort of constructed by this kind of image and being the seductive person and being the love man and being the sex man. And Luther was never about any of that. So I don't really know of like a big artist right now that, I know a lot of artists are trying to redefine that now, but somebody that's kind of redefined that and is able to have like huge commercial success and get a lot of people involved. I don't know that there's necessarily a figure that's involved in that, but I hadn't really thought about it with Beyonce in terms of Luther because she's such a different artist. But I just think that, you know, the pursuit of excellence and just the sort of like commitment to the live show just being just something that like if people, if their mouths aren't on the floor by the time they leave the venue, then you have not done your job. Like just to create an entire sort of like musical and visual experience, I think that's very much, I can definitely see a continuum there because Luther definitely elevated the R&B show, you know, with the Versace gowns and the this and that and his background singers. And that stuff was always as important to him as the music. And I think if somebody like Beyonce were like, yes, the visual presentation of the music is as important as the music itself. So I think that's a great comparison. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was mind blowing to read those parts of the book where you were just kind of outlining the budget that he had, you know, kind of spent on, you know, one of the shows was, you know, $1 million just to produce. And, you know, he had these like, yeah, specially made gowns and his suits and, you know, even for his backup singers, like it just is amazing the amount of effort and money and just, you know, kind of energy that he put into these productions. And I'm sad that I never saw them. So I know that you'd seen you went to Jamaica, you saw him perform there. Were you able to see his other productions or to see him?
Oh, live? Yeah. I went to see a show, I think it was like in 82 or 83. And I'm a DC baby. Like, so I was going to shows when there are shows that I don't remember. Like I was told that the first concert I ever went to was the Jackson 5. I don't remember that, but I do remember seeing, being at the Parliament Funkadelic show and actually the Mothership Connection tour and seeing the Mothership land. So I had I had these amazing experiences just as a very little boy, like elementary school and stuff like that. But when I saw Luther, I'm pretty sure it was the Busybody tour and just the presentation of that, because I also was privileged enough to be able to see some of the great Black Broadway shows at the time, like seeing The Wiz, the original Wiz with Stephanie Mills and Dreamgirls and all of that kind of stuff. So I was kind of aware of the concert aesthetic and I was kind of aware of the Broadway aesthetic. And so seeing Luther for the first time, and he kind of merged the two. So you were getting the live concert experience. But like I said, there was like an Alvin Ailey-ish dancer, you know, with the wrap dress and the dancing on top of things and a beautiful piano and staircases and set pieces. Like even having seen the Mothership landed, like I had never seen something so theatrical and so purposeful and such a like, you know, the kind of things that Madonna would go on to do and Janet Jackson would go on to do. And just now we kind of expect that when we show up to shows. But back then, you know, a show that you would see in a big concert hall wasn't really different than the show you would see in a small club. It was just they were standing on a different stage. But Luther was part of a generation that started rethinking the concert show for the larger spaces. And just to be able to witness that at really an early point was just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that.
I've seen that. And then I also even saw his very, very last tour after the Jamaica tour. I saw him. He came to Buffalo. And this must have been less than a year before he had the stroke. And it was, again, just such the level of excellence because the people that he worked with were just so excellent and so, you know, you talk about Black excellence, like it really was Black excellence on because everybody was so exacting about what they were doing. And he even explained to me, he even said that he gives a lot of criticism to his background, so not criticism, but a lot of feedback because these people want to be excellent. These aren't people that want to be coddled. These are people that want to be excellent. Because I remember when he was, when in the Jamaica tour, his song "Take Me Out," "Take You Out" was a brand new song, so the background singers didn't know it. And they were doing the backgrounds and everything like that. And at one point in the song, it's, I'll take you to a movie, to the park. Well, you know, people say, oh, let's go to the movies. You know, like, it's just kind of colloquial that a lot of people just add a plural onto movies. So one of the background singers did that, and he stopped the entire thing. And he said, somebody said movies. We are going to a movie. We are not going to movies. And I was like, oh, God. You know, like, some people are just like, that slide. But he didn't, and he was explaining. And he, it does make sense. The people that he was paying top dollar to be great, that they wanted to be corrected on that. They don't want to be saying the wrong lyric. So it's just a really example of Black excellence as not just something to kind of look back and appreciate, but to see the kind of work and precision and the having to be open to criticism that Black excellence entails and what it has to be done in order to achieve Black excellence. I guess that's my point.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. This is probably an unfair question, but I'm sure you get it a lot. Do you have a favorite Luther song? You've dropped a couple of titles, but I'm curious if have a favorite Luther song. I know this is probably a very difficult question to answer, but yeah, or a favorite album even.
Well, now I feel bad because my answer was, I had an answer, but now I'm like, maybe I shouldn't. But yeah, my favorite Luther song is Wait for Love, the ballad Wait for Love, because I just think that basically says everything you ever need to know about him as an artist and him as a person. You know, that's what he spent his life doing, you know, waiting for love, as a lot of people do, a lot of us do. And I it's also just so, like, he was really waiting for love in terms of the appreciation from the industry. He was waiting for love. I mean, it can be so applicable to so many situations. But yeah, I just love that song. Just always just takes me right to sort of the heart of his artistry. So that's an easy connection. Even when other people are doing it, like I once saw Faith Evans do it at the Essence Festival, and it connected me to Luther as much, if not more, because what it was like is, you know, it's sort of like when you're having a conversation with somebody about how much they love something, and like their appreciation can make you love it even more. It's like, even when people cover the song, it's kind of like having a conversation, and maybe they stress certain lyrics that you didn't necessarily see before. And I just think that song just always keeps revealing its depths to me and everything. I would say the favorite album would just to go back with the childhood, not really childhood, but I think I was like a preteen or like a teenager, but Busybody for me, because I connected to it so much before I had any idea really like about the complexities of relationships or anything like that. And like, it has remained relevant. The song, what he talks about in relationships, it has remained relevant throughout the years. Like, I'll Let You Slide, where a person cheated on him, but he lets them slide because of whatever reasons, you know, as I've matured in life and just seen the compromises that you have to sometimes make to be in a relationship. You know, that's, it also has Busybody on it, you know. A lot of us experience being in a relationship with somebody who was a busybody with other things. And, you know, that also has Superstar on it. And that was such an epic, to hear somebody merge Superstar and Until You Come Back to Me, and like have such an epic reading of that song. Oh, and the other thing about it too, is this is an interesting kind of segue and why it spoke to me so much in my teens, is because I was kind of like a really new wave teen. Like, I really loved like all the new, even though you know, all my background is just, you know, Black music, Black radio. Like, I went on some sort of like school trip, but like send Black children to Europe or something like that or whatever. It was like my teen years. But anyway, so when I was there, I fell in love with like the Human League and all these acts that used all these synthesizers. And on Busybody, he incorporates all of these kind of synthesized sounds into that. So it was really much, it was almost like a musical representation of how I was, my musical identity was developing, because I was getting all these influences of like the British New Wave synth pop bands, but also my heart was always in traditional R&B. And here you have this album that's bringing it all together. So yeah, that's a lot to say about it, but that's probably why that's still my favorite.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I've not listened to it. So I'm going to do that this weekend. So thank you for that recommendation. And you know, Wait for Love, it captures the longing that you really do pursue in the book. So I can, you know, it is a powerful song, and I can fully understand, given, you know, the process of you writing this book, why that would be a favorite. So one final question for you, before I let you go is, are you working on anything now that you're particularly excited about, or any projects in the future that, you're looking forward to, any other biographies or any, you know, kind of interviews or profiles that you're writing about or working on that you want to share?
Sure. I'm actually in the final process, like wrapping it up, of a Janet Jackson biography, which I plan to release next year. So that, even though I swore I would never write another biography after Luther, and I'm going to swear again that I will never write another biography after this Janet biography. But yeah, so... And again, it's sort of from the same impulse. It's just like, she's just this huge figure in the culture. But yet, if you wanted to find one source on her, where are you going to go? There's no book on her, sort of a comprehensive book on her life. There's no, the sort of things about her life and what makes her significant is so sort of dispersed all over everything. Place. So I wanted, just, you know, if I'm going to leave a legacy, if I'm going to want my kind of time on earth and time in this writing career to mean something, hey, I would like to be able to know that somebody after me is going to be able to have one place to go to find out the story of Janet Jackson, just like I'm glad that somebody has one place to go to find out the story of Luther Vandross. So that is, yeah, what I'm working on.
That is so exciting. Well, good luck with that project. I'm excited to, you know, comes out next year. I'll be excited to read it, and hopefully I'll be able to interview you again about it.
Oh, of course, anytime. This has been so great. It's been such a, it's been so emotional, but it's been really wonderful. I really thank you for the opportunity.
Of course. Yeah. And for me too, it's been like, yeah, like more, I mean, it was the reading the book was emotional, but this is, you know, just another layer of that emotionality. So, yeah, just thank you so much for this wonderful conversation, Craig, and really looking forward to reading more of your work in the future.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So this has been an interview with Dr. Craig Seymour about his book, Luther, The Life and Longing of Luther Vandross. I'm Carissa Pugh, and this has been an episode of New Books and Biography, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.